Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We figure the weekend is a good time for that. Time to lean back a little, slow down, meet somebody interesting, hear what people are saying. Of course, when we're not on the radio, you can catch up with us on Facebook. Just search Indiana Weekend. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, your comments, thoughts about whom we might talk with, or where you would like to hear our microphones. Our email address is, conveniently enough, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. The Midwest Writers Workshop is July 26th through the 28th in Muncie. As our friend Kathy Day reminds us, the faculty this year includes a Pulitzer finalist, a paranormal romance young adult author, four literary agents, a best-selling author of cozy mysteries, a poet, memoirist, indie publisher, and quite a few longtime editors and publishing professionals, including Jane Friedman. One of the organizers is Kelsey Timmerman, a Muncie writer who credits the workshop with helping jumpstart his career.
You know, Muncie, Indiana really isn't known as being the publishing capital of the world by any means. But when it comes to 3 days every summer at this writer's workshop, the publishing world comes to us. You can sit down with agents and pitch them. We have pitch sessions that everybody can sign up for, and usually you can sign up for at least one or two of the agents before the 3 days are up.
Any advice for would-be writers yourself?
Yeah, I mean, workshops were definitely key for me through the years. I had been to several before I had even gone to the Midwest Writers. I mean, each one has really kind of led to that next step in my writing career. Like at one, I met an editor for the Christian Science Monitor, and I had pitched, at one point in time, I had pitched like every single newspaper in the United States with a travel column. If they had a circulation over like 3,000, they got a pitch from me. And so she remembered one of my stories about spending the night in Castle Dracula, and I knew her name, and so I started talking to her and had lunch with her. You know, those are opportunities that you just don't get. And so she published one of my first, like, good clips, and I've published since then probably 8 or 10 other pieces with the Christian Science Monitor, which led to some radio work, which led to more stuff. And so the conferences have been great. The Midwest Writers Workshop has something that's a little bit different than I think a lot of them. You get a lot of encouragement, and there's a lot of opportunity there as well. So it's almost like a family at this point. I've been to, this will be my second year on the committee, going to my second conference, but this will be my fourth or fifth conference. And it's just some of the same people come back every year, and I've been invited to people's homes in Grand Rapids, Michigan before when I was in that area. And sometimes the conferences can get like depressing, because writing can be a depressing thing. Like, I'm still probably at like a 99.7% rejection rate for everything I've ever written in my life.
Oh,
you know?
Boy. Yeah.
So it can be depressing, but that doesn't seem to be the vibe at the Midwest Writers. The encouragement is there, and the opportunity is there as well. And it's right here.
So the Midwest Writers Workshop, who would have thought, in Muncie?
Yeah, so, you know, it's been around for 39 years. Next year, we'll celebrate our 40th year. And I'm just new to the conference, and it's really an honor for me to give back to a conference that has given so much to me. You know, it was started by Earl Kahn, who was a professor here at Ball State, and Dorothy Hamilton, who was a local writer. So it's always kind of been this mix of community and Ball State community kind of coming together. Jayma Bigger, who's the director of the conference, is just the heart and soul. She's been with it from the start. So like some of the people that are on the planning committee have been with this conference for decades. And I think that's what makes it special. And that's what brings that sense of family to it. And that sense of encouragement is just, you see the same faces year in, year out. And, you know, they're the ones planning it. And we're, you know, going into our fifth decade here in a couple of years. So it's a really exciting thing. And just to see some of the successes that we've had, we had Veronica Roth, who's the author of Divergent. She found her agent at the Midwest Writers Conference. Number one New York Times best-selling author. It's kind of like the new Hunger Games. I mean, it's following along that line of the Hunger Games. It's like a huge book, just a huge book. And she just came to Muncie, Indiana, you know, drove, I think she lived in the Chicago area. She drove down to Muncie, Indiana, thinking, well, I've got this book idea. And she found her agent here. Now she's a number one New York Times bestseller. So, you know, it's been a work of 39 years of people organizing it and bringing in talent and writers and editors and agents from all over. And I'm just so honored to be a part of it and work with people like Jama Bigger and some of the local poets and writers and Ball State faculty members.
Kelsey Timmerman, author of Where Am I Wearing? His Global Quest to Find the People Who Made His Clothes, talking about the Midwest Writers Workshop, July 26th through the 28th in Muncie. Details at MidwestWriters.org.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think at IndianaWeekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
The 17th Annual Middle Eastern Festival of Indianapolis will be held July 20th through the 22nd at St. George Orthodox Christian Church. More information at mefestival.org. Ball State's David Sumner is trying to get the word out. He was presenting a paper in Istanbul last month and says the trip reminded him how much he enjoys Middle Eastern culture and food.
One of the surprising things that a lot of people don't know that two-thirds of all Arab Americans are Christians. And so this church, like the Greek Orthodox Church, which has Greek heritage, but a lot of our church people come from Syria and Lebanon, not too many from Turkey, a few. But, you know, the Middle East is known for wonderful, wonderful food. I never had a bad meal when I was there.
And great hospitality,
oh,
really.
Very,
despite you're from the United States,
right.
How were you made to feel?
Oh, the people were very, very warm, very friendly. A lot of people say, did you feel safe? I felt safe every day.
We're talking about the 17th Annual Middle Eastern Festival of Indianapolis. The website is mefestival.org. And this is one of those kinds of things where I imagine there'll be some baklava, hummus, and that sort of thing.
Oh, lamb. I love stuffed grape leaves. Almost everybody likes hummus and pita bread.
Can you tell I'm a fan of these kind of festivals?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we sell a lot of food every year, and it's all homemade.
Is there a pretty sizable Middle Eastern community in central Indiana?
There is pretty sizable. A lot, you know, many are Christian, many are Muslim. There's the Islamic Center is in Indianapolis, and I don't know the exact number. You know, our church has 700 members, and the festival usually has 4,000 to 5,000 people in attendance every year.
Professor David Sumner of Ball State University talking about the 17th Annual Middle Eastern Festival of Indianapolis. It's mefestival.org.
Or Facebook.
Or on Facebook, yes,
right.
As everything is these days.
Everything is, yes.
July 20th through the 22nd at St. George Orthodox Christian Church on North Sherman Drive. David, thank you.
Well, you're very welcome, John. I appreciate your hospitality.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
The Midwest Writers Workshop is July 26th through the 28th in Muncie. Details at MidwestWriters.org. In our first segment, you met one of the organizers, Kelsey Timmerman of Muncie, whose book, Where Am I Wearing?, came from a global quest to meet the people who made his clothes in places like Central America and Asia. That's such an interesting subject, and we talked about the book, including where he got the idea for it.
Yeah, so really it just started as an excuse to travel. I'm not going to lie.
That's okay.
I had a shirt that had a tattoo from Fantasy Island on it, and it said, come with me to my tropical paradise. And I'm like, wow. At this point in my life, I had graduated from college, and I'd been working as a scuba diving instructor and things like that. And I would work a little bit, earn some money, and go travel, I started writing about some of these travels. And I was looking for that next destination, and I thought, well, I'll just go wherever Tattoo's Tropical Paradise is. So I thought I'd check the tag, and that's where I'd go. And I showed up in Honduras, and I did a lot of things that had nothing to do with my T-shirt. I went jungle hiking, island exploring, and things like that. And then I at least I should show up at the factory where the shirt was made. And I did, and they're like, you can't have a tour, because why are you here? This is weird.
Were they suspicious?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they weren't going to let me have a tour. And so I waited for the side of the factory for the workers to be let out, and I met a fellow by name of Amilcar. And I had a lot of questions for him. You know, I heard things about sweatshops and child labor, and what is life actually like for the people who make our clothes? And I didn't ask him any of those questions. I totally just, you know, that was really awkward. And I continued on my merry way. And then it just really started to bug me. So then as time went by, I became obsessed with clothing labels, where this stuff was coming from. I really want to know what life was like for those people. So then I went to Bangladesh, Cambodia, China.
What do most of us not know? Because we're used to seeing maybe some of those names on the labels of the clothes that we get. What do we not realize?
I think how labor intensive it actually is. So to make a pair of blue jeans at the factory I went into, you know, we started at, there's just like a Willy Wonka land of blue jeans. There's blue jeans and people everywhere and row after row of people. And you start at one end and there's swaths of denim and you walk past a bunch of people at the end, there's a pair of blue jeans. I was like, well, how many people does it take to sew together a single pair of blue jeans? 85 people.
And where was that again?
That was in Cambodia.
Oh, my gosh.
I followed my Levi's to Cambodia. Now, this wasn't a Levi's factory. Levi's doesn't have a factory anymore. They don't make blue jeans anymore, like most of the brands. Most of the brands are, they just design and sell and market. They don't actually produce them. So it's produced at these factories, often owned by some other company. But then also with these blue jeans, they're like, you know, 85 people, but that doesn't count the rest. And they took me into a room where these young girls in late teens, early 20s, by the age of 26, you're a wash up garment worker, take a perfectly good pair of pants, they frayed the pockets, they put holes in the knees of our pants. So, I mean, those holes, like,
what must they think of us?
They get put in there by, you know, by hand. It's really a manual process, and I think most people don't realize that.
Talking with Kelsey Timmerman, a Muncie writer, who's one of the folks putting together the Midwest Writers Workshop, July 26th through the 28th at the Alumni Center at Ball State University. Details at MidwestWriters.org. Did this, and I'm fascinated by your book because you got sort of your book deal arose out of one of these Midwest Writers Workshop events, and your book, Where Am I Wearing?, about the origins of the clothes that we wear. In the course of doing that, did this touch your conscience? I mean, are there things that we might rather not know about how our clothes are made?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, I mean, it was a life-changing experience for me. So I met a woman in Bangladesh who earns $24 per month, and rice costs $15 per month. And just to see how she approached the world and how amazing she was and how empowered she was and how she took care of her kids and how great of a mom that she was. And to meet people like that who have so little, and then to come back and to think that the, you know, right now, if you and I or if the listeners add up, you know, everything that they're wearing and how much that cost, it's very likely that you could get up to $1,000 really easy. You know, if I have my iPhone in my pocket and I'm wearing my glasses, I'm practically to, you know, I'm well on my way to $1,000 already. And to think about this woman in Bangladesh who earns $24 per month. And I think so somewhat this is dangerous thinking because it can lead us to think, well, what can we have in common with these people? And what this journey taught me is how much we have in common. You know, we just want what's best for the future generations, for our children. We sacrifice to have that. A lot of these workers the workers I met in China, they worked 100 hours a week. They hadn't seen their 13-year-old son in 3 years. They moved away for the opportunity to work at the factories to work. And one of the craziest stories is I met the very first worker I met, Emil Carr, in Honduras. I recently, this past November, I went back to Honduras to find him because I never asked him the questions I wanted to know. I wanted to, you know, what his life was like. So I show up there and I call the number I had for him. And a woman answers the phone, and it's his mom. And she said, oh, Emil Carr, he's in California now. So I'm like, California? And I was like, I probably should have called first before I came to Honduras, I guess. But so I spent the next few days with his family, and I met the mother of his three children, who they all live in a home that's paid for by the money that he sent home. From California, his mom, who's kept alive by medicine, she's ill and with medicine that he pays for from the money that he works for in California and sends home. He went on, he judged his life like, what kind of opportunities working in this garment factory give me? I think he was making $150, $200, something like that, a month. And he saw that he wasn't able to provide the type of life that he wanted to give, to provide to his family. So he packed up. And he took a bus to Guatemala, through Guatemala to Mexico, hiked illegally across the border, 3 days, like, walked, was drinking water out of, like, hoof prints of the cows, and eventually got on trains. And it's like this, so many Central Americans do this. They ride on top of the trains illegally and through mountains. And some places the Mexican people will throw bread at them just to help the migrants as they go north towards, you know, hopes and opportunities. And some places they throw rocks. And I mean, he was attacked the very first night. He was robbed. Everything was gone. Like, he had no money, nothing. It took him 3 months to get to the United States, and eventually made it across and made his way to California, and, you know, started a new life, but still to support the old one.
Kelsey Timmerman, author of Where Am I Wearing, and one of the organizers of the Midwest Riders Workshop, MidwestRiders.org. Do you have advice for people who are touched by the conditions that you write about?
Yeah, so I think that for me, that how it changed me when it comes to clothing was a small part of the lessons I learned, the way that I changed. So with regards to clothing, you know, I encourage people to wear a story. Just every day, wear one thing where you know that item of clothing comes from. And there's some resources out there, goodguide.com, goodguide.com, that kind of ranks different everything that we buy, you know, from soaps to clothes to shoes, on social and environmental practices of that brand, of that item. So that's a resource that people can turn to. And there's some other really cool companies out there. I'm wearing a shirt right now. It's a Ball State t-shirt.
I was looking at that, wondering what the story is there.
Yeah, so it was made in a factory in the Dominican Republic called the Alta Gracia factory. And it is one of the first living wage garment factories in the world. The workers that work at Alta Gracia earn 3 times the normal wage. And I mean, this really can really changes lives, can change generations of families.
They should put a logo or something on that so you can see.
There's a small logo here.
It looks like an A.
Yeah. So
okay. On the left sleeve. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So it's you know, it's really cool to see universities stepping up to get behind companies that are doing this. There's another company called Soul Rebels, S-O-L-E Rebels. They make shoes in Ethiopia. I visited them. And they also pay the workers about 3 times the normal living wage. They send the workers' children to school. They have, like, health care benefits. They have all sorts of different things that most people in Ethiopia don't have.
So do these clothes cost substantially more because they're treating people right?
Usually not a whole lot. I think this shirt might be, like, a $2 more than a, you know, basic T-shirt. But you go to a lot of college bookstores, and sometimes you can get stuff really cheap. You know, you can get, like, a T-shirt for, you know, $2 for $10 sometimes. And, you know, what is the actual cost of that in the long run? So it's not really expensive. I mean, a lot of times this stuff is a little bit more. But, you know, I really try to support companies who at least acknowledge where their stuff comes from, because so many people don't. A company like Patagonia has something called the Footprint Chronicles now, where you can go to their website and you can trace your shirt from where the cotton field, the cotton came from, to the textile mill, to the garment factory. And you can see sometimes interviews with the workers and managers, and at least, you know, you get a catalog and you look, and a lot of times catalogs will just say made in USA or imported, you know, but so some catalogs are starting to change this, and they'll say made in Indonesia, made in China, made in Malaysia, or wherever the item was made. And that's what I would like to see, more of a transparency. I think that they don't want consumers and producers to think about one another a whole lot.
Kelsey Timmerman of Muncie talking about his book, Where Am I Wearing? His quest to meet the people who made his clothes in places like Honduras and China. He's one of the organizers of the Midwest Riders Workshop, July 26th through the 28th in Muncie. Details at MidwestRiders.org. The fair weather skies have been pretty cloudless lately. It's tough on the farmers, not to mention the front lawns in many places. But good news for people outdoors, including Steve Reese, who flies an open cockpit biplane out of a small airport on the southeast side of Muncie. This is one of those 1930s-style aircraft with 2 sets of wings. Out of the 374,000 registered aircraft in the United States, very few are made with this design anymore. I bought a flying lesson from Steve, and we talked a bit as he did a pre-flight check of the plane. He talked about the fun of flying this kind of aircraft.
The open cockpit airplane biplane is the way to go. I would just much rather fly something like this. Like I say, I flew 35 years corporate flying. all over the country. Every day I would think, well, when can I get to fly a sport airplane next, you know?
So, and explain that difference, because in corporate flight you're in a...
Well, it's a more controlled aspect, actually a little more stressful because you're usually fighting the weather. This kind of airplane, we wait till a day like this to fly it. Where corporate flying, I was having to consider the weather everywhere we went and the stresses of trying to meet a schedule. And flying in the airspace system, we used to go to O'Hare three or four times a month. And I always enjoyed going to O'Hare, but it was a tense situation just because of the traffic level and the conditions that you had to fly under.
How do you explain flying to non-pilots?
Well, you can't. It's just something that I think you kind of know it too. It just has to be experienced, because a lot of people have never even been in an airplane. And if they have a desire to go, and once they get in the air, especially if you can get them up in something like this, they're pretty much hooked. It can't be explained. It's a total freedom.
Can you think of a time when you had a close call and you thought, boy?
Well, you have a few. You have engine problems, weather, because there is weather out there that can tear a light airplane. Well, it can tear any airplane apart. Every once in a while, you may get close to another airplane if you're not totally alert, or even if you are alert, you can look right at an airplane and not see it, and it'll surprise you. But really, nothing really, really that would make you think it was over.
You ever had to make an unplanned landing?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've had a couple of engine failures. I was teaching a student for SPINS, which they have to have for flight instructor certificate, in a Cub, Piper Cub. And he got a little aggressive on his spin entry and kind of went over the top a little bit, which is no problem, but he jerked the throttle back completely right then, and the engine quit just because it was at slow air load and jerking the throttle back. And of course, that has no starter on it. So we had to land in a field. And fortunately, of course, a Cub, you can get in anywhere. And it was a bean field that had been recently picked. Actually, you couldn't tell much difference in landing on a grass runway.
Pilot Steve Reese, owner of a biplane at a private airfield on the southeast side of Muncie. We have video of a ride in Steve's plane. Check it out at our Facebook page. Just look for Indiana Weekend. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you'd like more information or have a suggestion. Reminder that we also need your stories, ideas for places we should go and people we should talk to. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.